Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it. Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, interviewing the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. Speaking, I always say this, this is my just amazing transition. Speaking of bright and influential minds, my amazing, outstanding, commanding, demanding co-host, Liz Leiba. Liz, how are you today?
I'm just laughing at the commanding, demanding. I love that. That's like that's me in a nutshell. I'm doing great.
Yeah, and that's back to our tag team song. There it is. Should be your intro. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. And we're really excited. We talked before we started recording. We have an amazing guest. His name, and he's on the line today, Dr. Kevin Krueger, president at NASPA, which stands for the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators. Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Can I also be commanding and demanding while we're talking today?
Absolutely.
You can be whatever you want to be.
Of course.
Okay. That's great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Commanding and demanding is in a positive way. That's what we like to say.
That's right.
Around here. Liz will, I always say, you know, I'm going to throw you a few softballs to get you warmed up, and Liz is going to come with the heat later in the episode, and she doesn't think that she does, but she does.
I bring the heat. I'm going to get lit right now. Here we go. It's getting popping.
Well, I'll tell you what, Kevin, you know, it's an honor to have you on because I feel like this is, such a critical time for administrators working in student affairs, right? And your association, NASPA, is really the professional home for the field of student affairs and student affairs professionals, from VPs of student affairs all the way down to the first-time person who's stepped into student affairs. Needless to say, you've got a lot going on with student affairs right now. So what's it like out there? Give me the lay of the land.
Well, it's been a little chaotic, right? So I think one of the, you know, hallmarks of this for, you know, not just for student affairs, but for many people in higher education is the rapid transition we made in March to essentially being online. And many of your guests have talked about that from a curricular standpoint. But of course that meant also emptying residence halls and, you know, all a variety of other things around the campus. One of the things that's, it's really never let up since then. I think that's one of the challenges that we're facing. And so, you know, we kind of got through this spring semester and then immediately were thrust into this, you know, huge unknown, which revolved around whether or not we could, open our campuses live again and what that would look like. And so I think, you know, what many vice presidents of student affairs would tell you is that they spent a good part of the summer, you know, gaming out, you know, multiple scenarios that would depend on, you know, what the infection rate was in their communities, what the state policies were, what the governmental policies were, what public health said, what was possible at the campus level, whether availability of testing, availability of contact tracing, availability of quarantine residence halls. I mean, you can just kind of down the line. And so it's been chaotic. And I think you certainly have seen in the news that many, many campuses had a fairly elaborate and I think well-structured plan in place for a fall opening, a live opening, even if it's de-densified, and those plans got turned quickly on their head. So now I think we're in this kind of really mixed bag. We have places that are forging ahead and doing quite well, despite the risks out there. We have others that are, have some live instruction and they're battling hundreds, if not, you know, over thousands of cases among their students. And then we have some who are entirely online and have just gone that way because they thought it was the most prudent. So, you know, it's hard to get a quick snapshot of how we're doing other than to say that it's pretty varied and we have a lot of experiments going on. Some of them successful, some of them not. But we're learning a lot along the way about how you run a college campus in the middle of a pandemic and try to keep faculty, staff, and students as safe as possible. I think the other thing I would just mention, I think the other kind of prevailing thing that I keep hearing from my members is a sense of exhaustion because you know, not that summers are slow, but you might have had a little bit of time to kind of retool, recalibrate in the summertime. But because of the panic to kind of get all the, you know, all the pieces in place over the summer, I think everybody's feeling pretty overwhelmed. And we can dig into that a little bit more in terms of how, you know, sort of the morale and mental state of our field. But it's certainly been a, you know, a very difficult 6 months.
Well, and that's really interesting, and I would expect that. And I don't know if people really truly appreciate, and by people, I mean the external to higher education, the amount of pressure that's on student affairs professionals, administrators right now, because the decision-making is all variable, right? Even for a campus right now in a state that has low infection rates, let's just say it's a cold weather state that had high infection rates, those infection rates go low, cold weather comes, flu season comes, all of a sudden you're right back in the middle of that decision-making again when you thought you were clear, right? So the variability in the decision-making is just causing this level of uncertainty.
And I know,
and probably you do too, Kevin, uncertainty is the thing that kills you. It kills your mind. It increases your stress. What do I do? So, I mean, you haven't just, are some people throwing their arms up in the air saying, you know, we're going to throw some spaghetti against the walls here and see what sticks, are you seeing universities really sort of copy each other, for lack of a better way to say it, right?
There's a lot of learning from each other. I mean, you know, for example, I mean, all the institutions that are on the quarter system are going to school on everyone who's on the semester system to kind of see where they have had successes and failures. So I think that's, you know, it's one example. I think the stress and anxiety, the mental health issues overall, I think, are important to kind of just pause and reflect on at a couple of different levels. One is, you know, we haven't talked about students yet, but we know that students before the pandemic, you know, we were sort of an unusually elevated period where the number of students who had a diagnosable psychological disorder was at record levels. We know that now, given all this uncertainty and the fear and the anxiety, that mental health issues for students are, you know, at an all-time high and a huge concern for us. But we shouldn't ignore the impact it would have on staff as well. You know, one of the interesting things about student affairs staff or faculty, for that matter, or people who work in their dining hall, is these folks didn't take these jobs thinking that they were putting their health and safety at risk when they did their job. You expect that if you're a firefighter or a police officer, or perhaps even somebody in the medical field who's working at a hospital. There's a bit of anxiety and unknown about, you know, some of the folks who are actually on the front lines on college campuses, residence hall directors, student union staff, folks in the dining hall, folks in custodial staff. I mean, you can keep going down the line, who may feel very anxious about themselves, about the kind of risk they're taking. And you know, they need the job, and yet they may feel somewhat worried about that. So I think, you know, across the spectrum, I think it's a difficult time. And you mentioned sort of like, you know, what could happen. I mean, yeah, I think most campuses that are open with some kind of live instruction, with live residence halls, in-person residence halls, or just literally hoping to get through Thanksgiving. Because I think you saw, a lot of campuses adjust their academic schedule to and have the semester, or at least the live instruction, end at Thanksgiving, worried about students coming home for Thanksgiving and all the spread that sort of could occur. So, I think we're literally kind of hanging on and saying, can we just make it to Thanksgiving? It would be a huge success at this point.
Well, and that's interesting, right? It's like, send everybody home for Thanksgiving, change the semester, don't repopulate your campus till you get through the holidays, till you get through Christmas, and then let's look at it again in January. That's such a short period of time to plan. It's unbelievably short.
Yeah, right. I think for the whole world, we're in the midst of what we just dealt with, and then what we're dealing with right now with what happens in the fall, whatever. And then, you know, who knows what's going to the spring will look like. And I think, you know, already campuses are starting to, you know, make some tentative plans for the academic calendar and some plans for the spring semester. But we have a lot of unknowns, of course. We don't know anything about the vaccine. We don't know what the fall winter is going to be like. If Dr. Fauci is correct, it could be significant enough that no campuses will open this spring. I mean, you can imagine if we get back to levels we saw in New York or in Boston and other places in Louisiana, that we couldn't be in a place where, you know, it won't feel safe to open any campuses.
Well, Liz, I want to bring you in here because, you know, we talk about this all the time, the number of variables, and it's not just a coronavirus, right? There's other embedded things, and Kevin, you probably hear this too. There's this question of the value of a higher education. There's gap years. There's, I want my money back. I'm not getting what I wanted. It's debt. It's all these things. And then you throw diversity and inclusion on top of it, or a refocus of diversity and inclusion. And it's this compounding pressure cooker, Liz. What are your thoughts? And do you have a question for Kevin on those types of variables?
Because Joe talked about, you know, we are all handling it different ways and kind of maybe throwing some things on the wall, seeing what other people are doing. Maybe retool after we figure out if the infection rates have gone up. But at the core of this, we have people's lives. You know, we have students' lives, we have faculty's lives, we have staff's lives. And I think one of the, in terms of the critics that are opining about this, some of the things that they're saying is what is being used in terms of decision making. Do you have any thoughts? Like, how do we address that when we have critics that are out there, New York Times, or whoever, saying this boils down to dollars. You guys just want to get students back on campus, and you don't care about their, you know, how do we what do we do to recapture the faith in the fact that our decision making is sound?
Well, let's just acknowledge that there are a portion of the American public and certainly a portion of the media that are reflecting those sentiments that think that no college university should have opened for live instruction or live in any format given the state of the pandemic. So there are people out there who just think that that is a really bad and dangerous and reckless decision. And those same people probably would also reflect on the motives of opening as being largely financial and not in the best interest of students. So let me just acknowledge that sentiment is out there. I think the other things to think about are this. Obviously, it depends on, I think there's lots of factors, right, about whether you should or shouldn't open, about your community, the measures you're taking place, how isolated they are. There's a variety. So there's certainly a variety of factors. I think it's important to note a couple of confounding factors. There are people, there are students who are enrolled in universities, some of whom live in residence halls, for example, who have no other place to live and have no other place to be fed. We have a significant housing and food insecurity problem in the United States among college students, which is may come as a surprise to many of the people listening to this, but even in March when we closed down all live instruction, the campus never closed. The residence halls never closed. Many operated about 25% because international students, homeless students, foster youth, housing insecure folks, or people who didn't have a safe place to go back to their home. I'm reminded of a college president I spoke to last month who was reflecting on a student that was in her campus whose home was so dangerous due to gang violence that he just really didn't want to go home. But the campus didn't have a provision that allowed him to stay. He went home, and after that he had died from a gunshot.
Oh my God.
In his community. And she feels like what she says is, if we could have stayed open, he'd still be alive. Now, that's the end of one story. I don't want to over-dramatize that point. But the point is that for many students, the college campus is an important safety net for them. Okay, so that's one thing. Second thing is what we learned in March, even though they were getting better, but the students vastly preferred and felt like they learned more from in-person instruction. Now, of course, we're in this sort of hybridized environment now. We have, you know, it's been exposed in the media many times that many, many students don't have reliable internet. So the only way that they can actually access an education is to be near or on a campus. And so that's another factor we should consider. I think and then the last thing I just say is obviously money is a part of this. We can't ignore the money part. But the people that I know, I've talked to hundreds of people, leaders in higher education over the last, 3 months. And I don't hear, you know, not to say this doesn't exist, but I don't hear people, you know, saying, we got to open, otherwise we're going to go out of business. What I hear is, we want to open to try to create the best educational experience as possible for our students in the safest way possible. because they will benefit from that experience, educationally, developmentally, and, you know, despite the fact that the public sometimes is a little pessimistic about higher education, there's a clearly a value of a college degree that is just indisputable. Now, it's different. You know, Liz, you mentioned you work with a lot of adult and returning students, vets, that kind of thing. You know, for the adult learner, obviously, other forms of education, college degree is great, but, you know, certification, other credentials are, I think, are pretty valuable in that space. But for the traditional age college student, a four-year degree is the ticket to American prosperity. All the data suggests that. So, you know, we want to try to keep students connected to their institutions for the long-term value that they get from it. I want to say one last thing about this is that I'm very concerned, I think many of us are, about the unanticipated equity outcomes that may occur as a result of the pandemic. I take low-income students who whose families may have be unemployed, and so now college is no longer an option for them. We know low-income students are disproportionately first generation. They're disproportionately representing historically marginalized communities. I really worry about some of the progress we've made in graduating students of color, for example, increasing graduation rates and closing the achievement gap over the last 4 or 5 years. We may reverse or go backwards. And we certainly don't want a higher education system that becomes one that is based on economic privilege. And so that's a sort of a side note about what's happening, why it's important to try to get these students on campus and support them academically. So all I was going to say in the summary, in a long-winded answer, is, wow, is this complex? And there's just no single narrative I think we can use. Now, you know, it's a little troubling sometimes when we think about big time intercollegiate athletics. The jury is out about the extent to which, you know, these young people who are not being paid are generating hundreds and millions of dollars for their institutions. That feels a little yucky for some folks, because maybe that's not quite related to the educational mission. So that's one of the things I think that contributes to the way people feel that institutions are doing it for the money. So,
I'm a parent of a 21-year-old, and she's a traditional student, and she's been pressing her to, not pressing, but gently asking what her plans are. And I think a lot of that is she doesn't necessarily want to take online classes. She did not, to my chagrin, as an online instructor for the past decade, she did
of
not
course.
Do very well in her online classes. And I think she's on the cusp of probably taking a gap semester, if not a
yes.
gap year, because
yes.
she doesn't necessarily want to take online classes. What do we do better to close the achievement gap? You talked about that, and we talked about inequity. And I kind of feel like it's just one big pie, but it's like we're almost like, how do we fix it? Because one of the reasons why we're trying to open the campuses is because of the inequity with food and housing and all these students that are marginalized, or students that might not have nowhere to go. And we want to make sure that the students that are in the rural areas perhaps have access to internet. So they don't have access to internet, so it's going to impede the process of them being able to move forward. There's so many different layers there and so many different things to address. What is our responsibility? Higher education, her dad, my older daughter, in my younger college days, I went to University of Florida. Her dad was an athlete and was on full scholarship there at University of Florida and struggled, because his job was not to be a student. His job was to play football for University of Florida.
Right,
and
right,
when we think about faculty that sometimes, even as an adjunct myself, we don't have maybe money, or we're struggling to figure out how to address faculty contracts, but you have some schools, some of these big schools like the University of Florida, for example, or any other big college that has athletics where some of the coaches have multi-million dollar contracts. So how do we address, and a lot of students are students of color that are black students that are on the football team. So there's so many different things in terms of the inequity and what higher education needs to represent, but we're maybe falling short in some of those areas. I know this is a huge question and maybe something that can't be tackled in a short pat answer, but what is our responsibility to ensure that we are trying to close that? If we're saying that college is the great equalizer, okay, we got to get these students back on college. So, you know, a non-traditional student, maybe they can get a certification, but my daughter, a 21-year-old, she needs a college degree because she wants to be in computer, in the IT field. Okay, that's wonderful. She gets that degree. But then if she's earning 62 cents for a dollar that, you know, someone, a white male may be necessarily earning, then where, how do we, or she can't even get into an elite college because, you know, the, some of the hurdles that have to be jumped over because of, you know, all of the, like you said, the elitism that goes along with that process. It just seems like it's almost disingenuous for us to say it's a great equalizer if someone doesn't earn the same amount of money when they graduate, or somebody can't even get in the door because they're coming from a marginalized background and they're not even necessarily going to have access to some of these spaces, right? What do you think about that?
So let me just kind of, there's a couple threads that you've commented on. You know, let's just start with the one you just mentioned. I think that there is a greater, you know, pre-pandemic for some moment, a greater awareness of the privilege that it sometimes takes to get into college. And so you see a lot of press, you know, just take Washington University in St. Louis, and they got a lot of press about a super privileged institution and the low number of Pell-eligible students who were able to be at that institution. And you saw them kind of a little publicly shamed and then and now subsequently really kind of ramped up their efforts to bring in and subsidize more students who are from low-income backgrounds. That's, you know, so there's, you see that across the higher ed sector. We know that affordability is a huge issue, particularly for low-income students, and so I think the attention to that. So that's A. B, we also know to get students across the finish line, particularly students who may be coming from academic backgrounds that are not quite as rigorous, given the communities they came up, grew up in, but they need more academic support. They need more coaching, more tutoring. And so, again, pre-pandemic, we're making a lot of progress in student success centers and getting connected to these students one by one, looking at each student as a success story to try to help move to success. And there's some great success stories in higher ed about this that have been written in, across the higher ed trade publications. The challenge is a lot of that is sort of one-on-one, face-to-face. What do you do in a hybridized environment where now students are not quite face-to-face with you any longer? And I think one of the biggest challenges we're facing in expanding or at least continuing the student success formula is how do we do that now leveraging online interactions in a way that we've never had to do before. So that's a huge challenge. And, you know, I think the jury is out on that. I think a lot of that innovation is right now being developed on the fly. Now, going back to the very first thing you said about your daughter, because I have a daughter also who is a rising sophomore at the University of Maryland, she thought this, she had the same thought. She was like, I did not like online instruction. If it's going to be online, I may take a gap year. So I think that that's acceptable. We need to support our young people if they just don't feel safe or they don't feel like the learning environment is proper. And we're going to, I think we'll see some of that. And I think that when we get all the census of the admissions numbers from the fall, we'll see that we'll get a better handle on how many students actually have deferred for a semester. We don't know the answer to that yet. I think either way, I think, again, whether you're, no matter what your situation is, I think what we have come to understand, though, is whether it's hybrid or, you know, partially in person, partially online, we need to do a better job understanding what does online engagement look like, both for a faculty member, but also in the community itself. How do you build community? How do you create connections? How do you do some of the things that come natural when you have an in-person college environment, but now a little more challenging in the virtual world? And so I think that's a big challenge. I will say we haven't quite announced the whole thing, but we are working with a major funder right now to create a sort of a national a prize for campuses that are doing the most innovative work in online student services. And so we'll be able to hold up some of these exemplars to say, this is how you do it. Because there's a lot of institutions that have, you know, have already innovated in this space. And I think we want to find ways to scale that across some more higher education. So I think
Dr. Kruger, why does it always seem, you're talking about innovation, I'm sorry to over-talk you, but I just can't get this out of my head as somebody that's been on campuses for the past two decades. Why do I always feel like student services is always like an aside? It's like, okay, you're here for education. We really highlight admissions, Joe's in that area. We really highlight the marketing, or we really highlight financial aid. All these areas seem like they get like, and I worked in admissions, so I know. It's like you're the star of the show. You're getting the students in the door. But then sometimes I feel like with student affairs and the support personnel and some of the different things that you're focusing on in your strategic planning, the mental health and the career development and financial wealth, all those things, equity, all those things that I almost feel like get put on the back burner. I love the idea of this prize for innovation, but how do we keep that momentum going? Because I always feel like student affairs is like the most important thing, because you can't retain students and you can't, they're not doing your job, right?
Well, I think exactly. So I always think about, you know, the what happens at a college or university as having two critical pillars. One is what happens in the classroom, what happens outside the classroom. You know, obviously the classroom is the preeminent thing that we are doing here, but we also know that the outcomes of college, what employers value, for example, is not just what you learned in the English class and not just what you learned in the physics or math class, but it's how you, what are some of the cross-cutting skills you've developed as a young adult or, you know, adolescent that are really prized in the workplace, you know, communication skills, oral and written, leadership skills, innovation, ability to work in teams, ability to work in diverse teams. How do you learn that? You can't learn that from a book. It has to be in the kind of rich environment of the college experience. And I think that is the power of what student affairs does. It helps prepare students to lead a meaningful life in conjunction with what happens in the classroom. And the best campuses are doing kind of a handshake between what happens in the classroom, what happens out of the classroom. But you mentioned, you know, and then there's some, you know, some special occurrences, like, you know, you mentioned mental health. Well, you know, without the wraparound services around a college campus that support students' mental health around anxiety and depression and a variety of other things, many of these students wouldn't graduate. So that's super important. I think college presidents recognize that. So if you look at the most recent surveys of college presidents, they would put mental health issues as one of the top two or three concerns they have facing their campus. So I don't know that student affairs is on the side necessarily, but it's always sort of secondary to the academic mission. But increasingly, I'd say over those last 10 years, if you looked at the top five or seven problems that campuses face, a lot of them are focused, a lot of them are in the student affairs arena. And I would say our challenge as student affairs professionals is to be able to document through good science and evidence the impact of this, a student affairs program on a set of outcomes that we really value. And whether that be graduation or retention or acquisition of a job or acquisition of those critical competencies we talked about, I just talked about.
Hey everyone, this is Joe, just reminding you to check out our website at www.edupexperience.com, where you can find and explore all of the content that we've released under the EdUp Experience brand, including multiple podcast series, EdUp Elites, EdUp Embedded, and EdUp Experts. You can also suggest topics or guests for our podcast. Then head over to YouTube, check out our channel, The EdUp Experience, and you're going to find that my amazing co-host, Elizabeth Leiba, has started a new web series called EdUp Unplugged, where she talks about racism in America with special guests coming on that web series. We've got a lot going on at The EdUp Experience. Again, check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. Now let's get back to our guest.
Thank you.
What about investments in, this is going to be a two-part question. This will be the first part, but, you know, student affairs, to Liz's point, going down that same path, you know, a lot of institutions, as I'm sure you're aware, are seeing a level of enrollment decline, whether it's through a gap year or through non-returners or whatever the number of reasons are, coronavirus, doesn't matter. So you start to see a slimming of service, and generally those slimming of services happen first at a faculty level, because if you have less students, you don't need as many faculty. So there's been obviously well-documented furloughs happening across the nation, layoffs. And then you realize if you don't have enough students, well, your next spot really to start cutting is your number of services that you offer to students.
That's
because there's less students needing those services. You want to keep all of your money on the front end with enrollment and marketing and financial aid, because you're hoping for those returns to come back. So you don't want to slim down your revenue generators, to put it down to financial terms. So are you seeing a slimming of student services in general? Do you know, with the institutions you're talking with out there, is it like, okay, we're just hurting in student services right now? It's, we just don't have as much investment in those services as we had before.
Well, again, like every question, there's a complexity to this, right? So for a revenue-generating part of student services, so, you know, student union with a fee, housing, residence life,
right,
and dining with you know, that's one story. And then you have sort of, you know, sort of non-revenue-generated supported functions. So let's just start with the residence and dining halls. I mean, there's been already – so if you close your residence halls, so just close them down to 50% or even 75%, and students aren't in the dining halls at the same numbers, there's almost no way to do that without reduction of staff. So we've seen, in some cases, you know, significant layoffs or furloughs because there's not enough people in the residence halls and dining halls to support those staff, and you can only carry them for so long. So that's one kind of, I wouldn't say short term, but it's sort of an immediate impact. I think the thing I'm most concerned about, to your question, though, is not the, you know, immediacy of the pandemic and what that means, because that's one set of kind of, it's a long-term impact this is going to have on higher education. We already knew about the enrollment cliff and about, you know, decreases in number of high school students, you know, coming to college. That's still out there. And now with gap years or affordability issues or a variety of other things, as enrollment, you know, is more and more challenged, you have to make the numbers up somehow. Now, the challenge on the student affairs side is we are the smallest part of the budget. I mean, we tend to be between 8 and 10% of university budgets. So, you know, in an average budget that is largely made up of personnel, the biggest cuts are probably going to come at the faculty side, reduction of academic programs, those kinds of things. But then there also will have to be a commensurate reduction in services. The challenge here, this is a real tricky thing, because if you're trying to maintain your brand, part of your brand is the academic programs you offer. Part of it's also the quality of the experience. And so if you start cutting services too much and the public becomes aware of that, you may lose the advantage you have in the marketplace of your brand. So it's a very, you know, it's not just a matter of just cut all these services. What if that creates a sentiment that this is not as good a place to go to? The second thing is, some of the very services we're talking about are the services that support retention and persistence. If we start cutting those, we may end up great. We get all these students come in admissions and get to meet our class. But what if retention goes from 70% to 50% or 90% to 80% or whatever the percentage changes? Those services also, you know, we need to be careful we don't cut services that are actually maintaining the bottom line through a clear return on investment, which is keeping students in school. So it's a pretty complicated thing. I would say this, though. It's hard to imagine, let's just take 5 years from now, a higher education that doesn't have to operate with significantly less revenue than it has right now, probably pre-pandemic. Some of that is going to be enrollment-driven. Some of that's going to be state budgets. We haven't even begun to see the impact of the devastation that's occurred at the state level and what that will mean for support of higher education. We saw it in 2008, 2009. We saw dramatic decreases in state funding of higher education that never recovered. I think we're going to see the same kind of thing. And that, for our state institutions, particularly the regional public institutions and community colleges, is going to have a big effect on our ability to deliver what we promise for our students. And I think that's going to be the real challenge. That's the real conundrum we're going to face in the next maybe 10 years. And so I think, you know, if you look, look at the reading that, you know, what Kevin Carey and other folks are writing about, it's hard not to imagine that we're going to see a slightly different higher education system. Already, you know, we could say with pretty much 100% confidence is that we will be much more hybridized, you know, 3 years from now than we were, you know, a year and a half ago. And that means that, Liz, for those of you who are thriving in the online instruction area, that's going to be a stronger part or a more vital part of college instruction. And trying to create in a rich mix of classes that are online and also in person, and so that's going to change. Just like in non-higher education terms, you know, the idea that you have to go sit in a doctor's office to get seen by a doctor now seems kind of archaic. You know, when telemedicine is more readily available, and I think we're going to see similar macro shifts in higher education.
You know, what's interesting about what you said, and then I want to ask the second part of my question, but you're talking about slimming of student services and it affecting the brand and affecting the, you know, really anything you do to affect your brand affects your ability to recruit students in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you slim the service now, what does that mean for you 2 months from now, 2 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
And then you think about, to your point, about brand, about student experience, online learning, what that has done and what it will do is it's going to create a more transient student in the future. Maybe not right now as people are getting used to it. But, you know, think about a student 3 years from now and institutions that stay committed to online learning, at least in some capacity, who doesn't like the experience at the institution they chose. And so instead of feeling really hard to transfer, because transferring can be hard, right? You go home for a semester, you take online courses, you suffer through them, and you use that as a transition period to your new institution. I think we're going to see online learning used in that way to transition students to a more, positive experience if they're not having a good one where they are. So that's, you know, something that I think is going to happen in the future. But to the second question I want to ask you, and you kind of alluded to it a little bit, you're seeing institutions that are in trouble. We hear about it. We read it in the news where, higher ed, here are the list of institutions that are going to fail in the next year. And, you know, I think that it's really easy to make those levels of predictions, and it's very, and actually having them come to fruition is a lot different because there are more innovators in higher ed than we sometimes think, those people who look at it cynically. But who's in trouble from your perspective? Is it the regional publics that are most in trouble because of lack of state funding, because they're regional, because they don't have marketing budgets that can extend beyond border? Is it private, small private theological schools? Is it just a small private school that has 1,000 students that's in trouble? I mean, who's most in trouble right now from your perspective based on what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think the institutions that are in trouble were the same institutions that were in trouble 6 months ago before the pandemic, and now we've just accelerated their trajectory. It's a mix of what you mentioned. It's small privates with low endowments in regional communities or rural communities where the population is decreasing. And they don't have a national enrollment base. They have a local enrollment base, but that local enrollment base is shrinking faster than you might see in other areas of the country. So the Midwest, up in New England, you know, Vermont, places like that, those places are going to be challenged. It's not so simple. Like if you're up in Vermont, which is seeing a precipitous decline in high school graduates, and you're a private school of 1,000 students, it's not like you just say, well, let me just go recruit down in Texas. They're not coming to Vermont. I think you kind of have what you have. And so that's only one. We already know that the regional publics are stressed, particularly, again, some of the regional publics in smaller communities that used to serve a regional audience, but that regional audience now has shrunk as well. Look what Dan Greenstein is going through in Pennsylvania, looking at the challenges of all those regional Penn State and campuses that are spread around the campus, the country, the state, rather. So, I mean, those certainly are going to be a challenge. You know, the elites, the land grants, they'll never be in trouble. I mean, they may have financial challenges, but those aren't the ones who are in real danger. But the smaller you are, the smaller your endowment is, the less flexibility you have. What's interesting, which is like a sort of side note, I've talked to a number of small privates in the last month or so who you thought would have been, because of cost and maybe even, you know, maybe they were in that kind of category, were really going to suffer in this sort of fall semester here. Interestingly, and it'll be interesting to see when the numbers all come out, but a lot of small privates have done pretty well because I think families have felt like that's a safer environment because it's small and contained, and their enrollment's actually been pretty good. I've heard some small privates are, you know, of places that are not household names, but enrollment's up. Now I don't want to be overly optimistic about that. You know, I think it's going to be a mixed bag, but I think it's not quite as catastrophic as maybe people thought it would be. But look, before the pandemic, we saw, you know, the sort of parade of very small institutions that were either being merged or they went out of business. We're going to continue to see that. There's no avoiding that. I always come back to one thing. There's still a huge demand for higher education in this country. Even as we decrease the number of high school graduates, the number of students coming out of high school who want a college education is still enormous. So there's a demand out there, and so and that demand will be met by the market. That market will be slightly smaller than it was before, but not like we have to think like, oh, that's the end of higher education. Higher education is a bedrock of the United States, and it will continue to be. And somebody's got to meet the needs of that population. I always think back to Paul LeBlanc, who is the president of University of Southern New Hampshire. Maybe you had him on your show, and he's I remember hearing a presentation he did once about the coming of age generation. Now, again, this is not the older adult learner, but that the coming of age generation still wants a traditional college experience. I think that's true. Even in other countries, that's true. And he had sort of a funny line about that. He said, and he said, parents still want their kids the hell out of the house. And that was sort of kind of amusing, but it's kind of true in a way. I mean, it's hard to imagine a whole generation of 17, 18-year-olds wanting their college experience to be in the basement of their parents' house. So I think that there's still going to be a demand for the traditional experience. But like you said, and I think you're absolutely right, more swirl. Yeah, like, yeah, not, you know, the go to school, spend 4 years at school. I mean, yeah, less of that and much more like, you know, do more study at a community college, get a credential here, get a course here, look for the best option, be more flexible. Absolutely. This goes back to, I remember hearing some folks at Lumina several years ago talking about, their vision always was like a passport, like you get your passport stamped. So every time I get a course, I get a stamp. I carry that passport around with me.
Right.
I'm not wed to a single institution. We're a long way from that model, but you certainly can see a lot more kind of market swirl that I think will take place as students sort out what they want to do, particularly as we come through the pandemic.
Well, interesting, you go back to your Vermont thing and you go, okay, nobody from Texas is going to come to Vermont. But if that Vermont institution has shifted, at least in small part, to online learning, and Liz has heard me say this a million times, mm-hmm. whoever the president is there at that Vermont institution or whoever the president's going to be has to know online marketing to some degree, has to have the vision to compete in an online space. It is completely different
than on-ground,
you know.
Agreed. However, I would just say, to some degree, I only worry that horse left the barn a little while ago. So that small private you just mentioned, Vermont, and now is up against University of Southern New Hampshire. They're up against ASU. They're up against UMass. They're up against these behemoths that are now taking over the online space with marketing dollars that no one can compete with. So it's a very difficult market to enter now. I think the niche, and I think some small privates are recognizing this, niche isn't for the small school in Vermont to try to get students in Texas to enroll in their online program, but to use that as a way of expanding their Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts footprint.
Regionally.
And I think as we see these regional institutions really struggling, the online component can open up markets there in that adult learner space that they didn't have before. They may have been a small, private, really bucolic residential campus, but now they could potentially reach workers, adult learners, vets, other folks who are in their surrounding communities with the brand that they have. But you're right about that. The president and the staff have to see that that's a very different enrollment management strategy than they have used before with 18-year-olds.
Well, let's. Here's your final couple of questions then. What are we going to see in the next 5 years from your point of view, Kevin? What's the future of higher education look like to you in a minute or less? And then is there anything else about NASPA that you would like our audience to know or hear about? Probably some people on here, student affairs folks that listen to the podcast that are not members or institutions that are not members.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about the benefits of NASPA for a minute, that would be great too.
Great. Well, I think I sort of sums up some of the things we've already talked about. I mean, what's higher education going to look like? It's going to be more, once we get past the worst of the pandemic, it's going to be, clearly more hybridized. I think equity issues are going to be a huge and important issue, and racial justice and social justice issues are going to be more important than ever. And I think given the shaky confidence that the public has about higher ed, I think we're going to have to reconnect the higher education experience, the college degree or certificate, with a meaningful and valuable employment in the workplace. Because that thread's probably a little bit broken right now, given the economy. We've got to reattach that a little bit so that it's the value proposition, retained. So that's going to have to be a really important piece going forward. NASPA continues to try to create a community of folks. We have 16,000 members at over 1,200 institutions. you know, and our goal really is to help prepare institutions and their campuses to operate in these difficult times. I would say that the last thing I'll say is, you know, before the pandemic, we were talking about student success. That was the language and the coin of the realm for higher education. And I think that post-pandemic, it still is. That helping students get across the finish line, removing barriers, connecting with students who historically have not achieved a college degree at the same level is the highest priority of higher education. It was before, and it needs to be again. And I think that that will continue to drive our work.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com. And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen in live and get the scoop before anyone else does. So please, as always, feel free to share this podcast. Rate, review, and subscribe. We would really, really appreciate that. You've been listening to The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Liva, and Elvin Freitas.